Devlin's.
Which one's it?
314.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. The first item today will be Senate Bill 314. Senator Prozanski. Old habits die hard there.
Thank you very much. Bill 314 comes to you out of the process from the Senate. It basically would require an individual who's involved in some type of a motor vehicle accident to take steps that would allow for immediate reporting of that accident to law enforcement that where there was injury or death. The reason for this is to make certain that individuals that are involved in these situations do report in a timely manner. Currently, there is no requirement for an immediate reporting, and can actually time can pass in the sense of length of time before the reporting is actually occurs. Our concern here is to allow law enforcement to determine whether or not they need to investigate and move into a investigation process regarding an accident. So the bill itself would require these type of accidents to be reported, and I do want to point to the committee. There was some concern that was raised after the bill was passed with the city of Eugene, and I believe maybe one of their representatives may be here to discuss an -1 amendment. I've had an opportunity to look at the -1s, and I would caution the committee in moving forward with the -1s for one reason. It says that it would be replacing part of the bill where it says that you need to report to a police officer, but instead need to report to a 911 emergency reporting system. Well, not all 911 reporting systems are available to everyone in the state, and more importantly, some of these reports do not need to go through an emergency reporting system as compared to getting it to the law enforcement agency. So in smaller communities, they can call directly to the agency without needing to go through a 911 system. The top of the bill on the amendment on the -1s lines 1 through 3 wants to make sure that individuals understand that the requirement that would be required under SB 314 is separate and distinct from those that would be required to be reported to DMV. That's required in a 72-hour reporting process, and we have no objection to that. But if the committee wants to make a change regarding who the report needs to be done, I would suggest that it needs to be to a police officer or a law enforcement agency, not to 911 system. And with that, I'll try to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Senator. I'm just trying to think, in some small community in Eastern Oregon that may not have any police around in the middle of the night, wouldn't a 911 attempt to call a 911 center to let them know?
I think that would be fine, but if you limit it to that they have to report to a 911 system, and that's what the bill says, then that somewhat could be interpreted that they would not be in compliance with the statute if they called a police department directly. Because as I think most of the members of the committee understand, 911 systems are sometimes operated as individual units. They're not directly tied to a police department, and actually field calls for multiple agencies who then dispatch the call out to the appropriate agency. But I'm not saying they shouldn't be able to use that process. I just think that the way the amendment has come out, it basically shifts it to an emergency reporting system where that may not be necessary. Of course, it could be very broad. You could say to police officer, to a law enforcement agency, or a 911 emergency system, and that would cover probably all of them.
Great, thank you. We don't have the -1s before us today, so so this may need a little work.
Yeah, the proponents are the City of Eugene, and they provided that to my office. I believe I received it this morning. I'm not sure if my office got it yesterday or not.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Any questions? Yeah. Representative Olson.
Senator Prozanski, to kind of follow up with what the chair was mentioning to you about the 911 contact, I can kind of see that as being a problem to some degree. I mean, should you have the smaller agency, especially Burns, for example, out on Highway 20, that they would call your 911 center at least be routed to that over there would be Ontario. But if they have a CAD system, a computer-aided dispatch center, I can see that as working. I don't know if you've given any thoughts toward that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, I have no problem with this being expanded and being very broadly, let's say, accepted for where you make that phone call. What has happened, and this came from Tom Sywell at his request, who's an officer in Florence. There are many times where accidents occur and no one's reporting it, and so no one's being dispatched, and they find out maybe some hours later that something has occurred. And whether there was any, let's say, reasons for an investigation, such as someone being DUI when they had the accident, and that's what one of the issues that we're trying to address. But clearly, if the committee wants to broaden this to include multiple receptacles for filing those reports, I have absolutely no problem with that. I just didn't want to burden 911 system or have that as the exclusive way, since that may not actually be appropriate.
Yeah, I understand that. I agree with you. Follow up,
please.
The issue in Section 2, Line 7, public resulting in injury or death, the injury part, have you given any consideration maybe of describing what type of injury, whether it be a serious type injury or just a real mild injury, one that would actually cause you not to have to go to a hospital?
Well, the statutes for hit and run are broken down as to whether there's an injury, and I would assume we would use the definition for injury within, I believe that's 811-700 series is where the hit and run is at. And that's what I would interpret that they would be requiring to be reported. And of course, the reality is also sometimes it could be soft tissue injuries that may not be pronounced at the time of the accident. And those, of course, would be ones that would not need to be reported if it wasn't something that was known to the person at the time of the accident that there was, in fact, an injury.
And I just have one final question, Mr. Chair. Do you know how many other states are kind of doing something similar to this for immediate reporting?
Chair, Representative Olson, I don't know the numbers for all the states. What I do know is the base and of the language that's used in our bill, Senate Bill 314, came from Alaska, as from what their statutes provide. Again, Officer Sywell was at one time an officer in the state of Alaska. He has asked me on numerous occasions about considering this, and I felt that I'd go ahead and put it into the hopper this time. And he provided me with the statutes that came out of Alaska.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your questions. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 314. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 380. Senator Devlin, please.
And Senate Bill 380 allows an expert witness in a criminal trial to testify via simultaneous electronic transmission if both parties consent. There's no fiscal or revenue impact on this bill.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee, for allowing me to come before you today in support of Senate Bill 380, and I will also refer to the Dash 1 amendments in my remarks. I will be very short. Senate Bill 380 comes before you today after the staff of the Senate Majority Office took a tour of the Oregon State Police Forensic Lab last year. It was explained to me on that tour that the lab has the technology to allow forensic scientists to testify by simultaneous electronic transmission in court proceedings, but that a circuit judge court had ruled appropriately that the type of testimony cannot occur when the case is being presented in front of a jury. Would change the law to allow for this type of testimony by expert witnesses only if there is written consent from all parties involved. The Dash 1 amendments that will be before you are being brought by the Judicial Department, and was in this case it would allow any witness to testify through simultaneous video with written consent of all parties. The intent of this bill was clearly to to economize on resources. Obviously, it's an issue of dollars, but it's also an issue in terms of resources for the forensics division, which the division director, Mr. Wampler, is here today to testify to you later about those resources. And when a forensic scientist is off 300 miles away testifying in a case, there is work that is not being done. And this would be a way to do this expeditiously. It would require the consent of all parties. It would save money. It would save resources. And in this particular time, there's probably on the mind of everybody trying to use resources as effectively and efficiently as possible.
Any questions for Senator? Thank you, Senator Danwood.
Thank you.
Gail Myers and Randy Wampler, please.
Good afternoon. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Randy Wampler. I'm the director of the Forensic Services Division for the Oregon State Police. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 380. And in 2006, we received federal grant funding for the purchase of the video conferencing systems that we currently now own. And using the justification for the efficiency of our operations and keeping individuals in the lab versus driving multiple hours to courtrooms. In 2008, in September of 2008, we discovered through a court trial that there was a statute that disallows the use of simultaneous electronic transmission or video for jury trials. Subsequently, Senator Devlin introduced this bill for us at my request. Just to kind of give you an example, 2008 was our first full year of using the system of video conferencing for testimony, and in just 39 uses of the system, we estimated that we saved approximately 240 hours of driving time, over 13,000 road miles that were saved, which equated to roughly 400 to 450 gallons of gasoline. In contrast, just to give you an example, in 2008, there were 452 total testimonies that we performed in the forensics division. So just a little under 10% were able to be done by video last year. So there can be, that kind of demonstrates to me that there can be a big savings in driving time on those cases where it's not necessary for us to be on the actual stand in the courtroom when both parties agree that we can be testifying by video. That's all I've got. And if you've got any questions for me, I'd be happy to take them.
Yeah. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are in favor of Senate Bill 380. We do have concerns about the Dash 1 amendment. But as to the original bill, we did testify in its favor in the Senate side. We recognize its efficiencies and cost savings as it relates to expert witnesses. Frequently, the defense wants to hire an expert who might be out of state, and it can certainly save money, whether it be an appointed case or not, to have that expert testify electronically. So we think that's a good way to go. Our concerns with the Dash 1 are subtle, but they're there, and they won't go away, really. We're concerned about a dilution or an erosion over time of the expectation that witnesses will testify live before a jury at a jury trial. The Dash 1, of course, applies to any witness, not just an expert. And we recognize that on its face it is balanced. It does apply to the defense witnesses as well as the states. It certainly does allow for protection for mutual written consent of both parties. But we do know from our experience with relate to the opportunity for some of the forensic crime laboratory witness, we've got provisions now that with forensic lab reports that we can just get the lab report in and not have the witness. There is a subtle pressure on the defense to sometimes not demand that the forensic scientists get there live, that, and then it becomes a bargaining of different favors. If you want that witness, then how about if you do this? And we're just concerned that over time there might be an erosion of that expectation that at a jury trial, witnesses will testify live in real before the jury. So we express those concerns, but as to the bill itself, we support it.
Questions? Representative Garrett.
Yeah, I think that you raise an important point. I think it goes beyond this bill. Is anybody looking at that in a more holistic way? Is that something we should ask the law commission or somebody to take a look at? Because as technology progresses, this is going to become more and more of a question, I think.
Yeah. Chair Barker, members of the committee, and Representative Garrett, that's just it. We're entering a new era. It's the electronic era. And what will that do to the jury trial where we have always insisted that the witness come through the door and sit in the jury box, the witness box, and let the jury see them? I don't know where this will go.
Do you know, Ms. Myers, do you know who proposed the dash ones?
Chair Barker, my understanding is the Judicial Department.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you. Sorry, I have one other person to testify, Jody Burita. Beretta, like the Italian piece. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Jody Beretta. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County. I'm here today representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and we are in favor of this bill and of the Dash 1 amendments. As you've already heard, this bill, there's just no downside to this bill. You've heard about the economic benefits, that we will no longer be wasting money bringing out-of-county or out-of-town witnesses, and that's a very real benefit to this bill. Talking as a district attorney, there's also another benefit to this bill and a requirement that it be all witnesses, not just an expert witness. I'll give an example from a few years ago in a murder trial that happened here in Marion County. There was a witness who may not have been determined to be an expert, but was a law enforcement witness who was actually ordered to bed rest as part of a high-risk pregnancy. She couldn't be there for trial, and it was a sudden development. Both parties agreed that there was no problem in having her call in from her bed and testify. However, because the way this statute currently exists, that couldn't happen. That sets up the dilemma of either a set-over of a six-week-long jury trial at great expense to the state, to indigent defense, and to the inconvenience of all the other witnesses. It also raises some speedy trial issues, and her testimony wasn't in dispute. The only time that this bill would come into play is when neither party objects. That means the issue that the witnesses will be presenting is just not one that's in dispute. There's no downside to this. We need to broaden it to be more than just experts, because it's a very few number of witnesses in a criminal trial that will ever be determined to be an expert. And really what this is just a cost-saving measure to help out the county, indigent defense, and all the state agencies that are providing witnesses in criminal trials. ODAA would ask you to pass this bill. We think it's a good bill, and I'm happy to entertain any questions you may have for me.
You heard the defense bar. They're concerned about not having witnesses in the courtroom, which I think is preferable to not having them myself. But it also would appear to me, if I'm not mistaken, that it's covered because they could just say, no, we're not going to waive.
Exactly. And this bill protects all sides, because you can always say no, and I would submit it's actually a defense attorney as well as a prosecutor's obligation to say no if it's not in the best interest of their position. What's also important about this bill is that it takes away no discretion from the judge either. The judge is still in control of the courtroom because it doesn't require a judge to allow a witness to testify through electronic transmission. It merely permits them to allow.
Okay. For questions, anybody? Okay. Thank you. What's your pleasure?
Well,
close the hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 380. We can talk about it.
No, 380.
Yeah. Fine. I can do it.
Dash ones.
Bill 380.
Dash ones. This is Devlin's bill.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move the dash ones in Senate Bill 380.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash ones in the Senate Bill 380. Is there any discussion? Representative Stigler.
Yes. Having been someone who has had situations arise that were unexpected in trial situations where the ability for electronic to have the witness testify electronically, and in fact we have pursuant to agreement and putting everything on the record, I just think this makes it a little clearer, cleaner, particularly in criminal cases. And I see, particularly since it includes the ability of the court to essentially veto anything the parties may agree to, if they feel that it's important that that happen. I don't see a downside to it. I think it's a pretty equally weighted amendment.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Representative Shields?
So am I understanding this correctly? This was an amendment proposed by the judicial branch, but nobody from the judicial branch has told us why they're advocating for this.
Well, I think in reading it, it seems what the difference is they eliminate the word expert witness, so that a witness who isn't qualified as an expert, and sometimes that's difficult to be qualified as an expert. And there again,
would it be possible to hear from the judicial branch since they're
here? Oh, yeah, they're here. The judicial branch is here.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Shields. I had taken the time to talk to each one of you about this bill prior to the Dash 1 amendments being submitted to the committee, and I'm available for any questions. Our perspective was that we had actually had some discussion within the Criminal Justice Advisory Committee under the Chief Justice about whether or not there should be an allowance in criminal jury trials for witnesses to appear by simultaneous electronic transmission. It is currently allowed in civil trials. There are situations that arise in criminal trials that are unexpected. There are witnesses who are out of state who can't afford to travel. There are inmates who are held at state penitentiary facilities who, when they leave the facility, actually lose their privileges. And when they go to a trial and then return, if they had a job in the kitchen, if they were engaged in other programs, they actually have to start from scratch. So the Judicial Department over time has received requests to allow witnesses to appear in criminal trials by simultaneous electronic transmission, and because of the statute, we've had to deny those requests. So this amendment, with the Dash 1 amendment, would simply allow us to, when appropriate and when the parties have given consent, allow an electronic allow electronic testimony. So I'm available for questions if anyone has them.
Representative Garrett.
Use the wall.
Has this been discussed with the criminal law section of the bar? Is there? I'm just a little bit concerned about how much deliberation went into this. I'm sure there was plenty on your end, but I'm wondering about other groups.
Chair Barker and Representative Garrett, members of the committee, the Chief Justice's Criminal Justice Advisory Committee is actually comprised of many, many representatives from within the criminal justice public safety system. We have representatives from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We have representatives from the District Attorneys Association, sheriffs, Department of Corrections. I don't have the list with me, but it is a broad spectrum. We discussed it two times, first, I believe, in January of 2007, and again as we got closer to session, I believe it was October of 2007. So we had the discussion at two different times, and at times actually had the support of OCDLA, and then it waned back again. And so I understand that there are changes of position and there are different concerns that arise at different times. What this bill does, though, is with the written consent provision, it does give the protection that if a party truly doesn't consent, their hand cannot be twisted into giving it.
Questions? Thank you.
We have a motion for us to adopt the dash ones.
and I think there was some explanation there. It has been vetted. The example of the prisoner would not be an expert witness, and a lot of times even the police officer is not qualified as a court expert witness, and so they would be able to testify. I think this would not come there. Any objections to the dash ones? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Whiston.
I move Senate Bill 380 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Whiston, I move Senate Bill 380 as amended to the floor of a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whiston.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Carries.
Representative Stegner.
Sure. Stegner will carry it. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 106. And let's see. Michael Mason and Gene Strait. Please.
Chairman of the committee, Senate Bill 106 comes to you from the Oregon Youth Authority, allows the Oregon Youth Authority to provide funding to federally recognized Indian tribes in Oregon for services for at-risk juveniles. There you have the dash two amendments in front of you, which would remove a provision as it relates to diversion funds to the tribes.
Okay, please go ahead, just identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Jean Strait, and I'm with Oregon Youth Authority. I would like to just tell you a little bit about the bill. Currently, when the Youth Authority receives grant funding or funding from the legislature for intervention funds, we can only contract with the county currently. What this bill does is allows us to request the tribes to solicit for that money and then gives us the authority to contract with them for these intervention funds. So that's what the bill will do.
Mr. Mason.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Michael Mason. I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs here today, and the tribe supports Senate Bill 106A, which provides limited authority to the Oregon Youth Authority to make grants to tribes. This started as a bill to help with funding for gang-related activity or to combat gang-related activity. The tribes have been very interested in working with OYA for at least 12 years. They welcome OYA's cooperation as evinced by Senate Bill 106A in accord with Senate Bill 770, the State Tribal Government-to-Government Relationship Act from 2001. We don't have a problem with the dash two amendments. I did want to mention the gang issue has really hit home at Warm Springs last summer. There were two gang-related murders. This has never happened before. Stunning is a mild word for the impact it's had on the reservation. So, again, it's important to have this cooperation, and they welcome it. I just spoke also with Justin Martin of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, and he has authorized me to tell you that his tribe also supports Senate Bill 106A and has no issue with the dash two amendments. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Do we have dash twos? Do we have dash twos?
I don't have them.
No, I don't have them.
I didn't understand the dash twos are in the engrossed. I don't know that.
No, Mr. Chair.
Not.
To be here, Mr. Chair. I'll get a copy for you, but I can also tell you what they do, going to the bill. On line 9, page 1, 2A, except as provided in this paragraph B of the subsection, that's removed. And then line 13B, that's 2B, is removed also. So instead of reading as except as provided, it starts off the Oregon Youth Authority may receive applications from, etc. And then as it relates to 2B, tribes are not eligible for diversion funds under ORS 420.017. That's been being removed. I have is Senate Bill 238. I will get a copy of the amendments. We can come back to this if you'd like.
Okay. Yeah, okay. People need to come back to that then.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. We'll wait for the amendment until we have it. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 106. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 238.
Chairman of the Committee, Senate Bill 238 comes to you from the Estate Planning Section of the Oregon State Bar and Acts the Uniform Guardianship and Protective Proceedings Jurisdiction Act.
Catherine Ruckel and Lane Shetterly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll lead off here and then turn it over to Ms. Ruckel. My name is Lane Shetterly, a practicing attorney over in Dallas and a member of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, from which comes House Bill 238, a bill to enact the Uniform Adult Guardianship and Protective Proceedings Jurisdiction Act. Don't try to say that with a mouthful. But it's a really good bill. I'm pleased to be here in front of you, both having had a role in the drafting of this bill. I actually had the honor of being on the drafting committee that drafted this bill for the National Uniform Law Conference. We met over the course of a couple of years, about six times, over two-day stretches each, drafting this bill. A work group that included practitioners from around the country who practice in guardianship and conservatorship laws, as well as observers from groups like National Probate College, AARP, and others who are interested in this area. The bill came to the bar, which introduced it through the estate planning section. It was heard in Senate committee a couple of times. There were a couple of issues that were largely dealing with terminology just to make this thing work better with Oregon law. The Senate convened a work group that included myself representing the National Uniform Law Conference, as well as members from the Judicial Department, Department of Human Services, the Elder Law Section, and David Niebel from the bar. We made a few amendments to the Uniform Act that were engrossed into the bill that you have before you, it comes to you today without opposition, with full support from the bar as well as from the Uniform Law Conference. Just briefly, three main points to it, and then I'll let Ms. Ruckel give you a little bit more of the details. It addresses real-world issues that come up in guardianship and conservatorship proceedings, one being that of jurisdiction where you have more than one state involved, that is, a situation where a guardianship or conservatorship has been filed and is pending in two states, maybe where a mom has been living in one state, but son has come and over the weekend has removed mom from the state in which she's living and has taken her back home with him and initiates some guardianship or conservatorship proceeding to try to get control of mom's assets. Now you have two states that may be involved in potentially having jurisdiction. This bill lays out a roadmap for the states to apply in determining which state goes forward, favoring what's called the home state. That's the state in which the protected person has lived for the 6 months, is going to have the most connections. It's where the medical care is going to be provided. Friends are going to be able to testify as to that person's needs. But the hierarchy for determining jurisdiction is laid out in the bill and will be of great assistance to courts when presented with these issues of competing guardianships and protective proceedings. The second thing that this bill does, apart from determining or helping to determine initial jurisdiction where there's a dispute, is it addresses an issue of what happens when you have a guardianship or conservatorship established in one state and maybe for very good reasons that protected person needs to be moved to another state. Again, using mom as a situation, if daughter's been her conservator and her guardian and now daughter is moving to another state and wants to bring mom with her, or if daughter is not able to be guardian and conservator anymore and needs to hand off to brother in another state in a cooperative way. Under current law, if mom moves as a protected person, you have to start all over again in that other state and go through everything that state requires in order to establish a protective proceeding. It can be very expensive to do it again, and this bill creates a method whereby one state can transfer a guardianship or conservatorship to another state to allow that protective proceeding to go forward without having to make all of the same initial showings that you would have to make in initial guardianship or conservatorship proceeding. A great benefit to protected persons and frankly to courts as well. It will save time for courts and also for attorneys that practice in this area, reducing their workload and expenses to litigants. And the last thing it does, if you have a situation where maybe mom isn't going to be moving out of state, but maybe she lives in, this is an Oregon or Washington guardianship, let's say in Clark County, and mom is going to need medical care for a short period of time. She's not moving, but she's going to need medical care at a facility in Oregon. This clarifies that by registering that Washington proceeding in an Oregon court, Oregon will acknowledge the conservator, the guardian's authority to consent to medical care, again, without having to start a new proceeding in Oregon just for the purpose of some short-term need. In dealing with property, it allows conservatorship to be recorded out of state so that you can sell property without having to initiate a new conservatorship proceeding in that other state. Again, great benefit to protected persons and people who care for them as well as for the courts. One thing I would mention, I think it's, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Ruckel. Often this committee likes to know, and so I'll tell you, I think it's in the testimony, but just so you know, this bill has been introduced now in 19 states. It's pending in 19 states this year. It has been enacted in 8 states. It's a new act. We expect that there will be very wide adoption of it within the next couple of years. And so I would commend it to you as a very enactable bill. One of the reasons I think this is particularly useful for us is that Washington has already adopted this bill. And when you consider the cross-connection of these kinds of proceedings, particularly in the metropolitan area between Portland and the Clark County area, this will be of great benefit right out of the gate to Oregon and to Oregon courts and protected persons within this state, as well as then reciprocally those in Washington as well. So it's a great opportunity for two sister states to adopt this closely together and really start to watch it work in very short order. Thank you. Questions? Please, go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Ruckel. I'm an attorney who's a member of the estate planning and elder law sections of the Oregon State Bar. I'm an associate at the firm of Cartwright & Associates in Portland. We do probate litigation and some administration, and the focus of my practice for the last 3.5 years has been on guardianships and conservatorships. I'm here today to provide testimony on behalf of the estate planning section in support of this bill. Widespread passage of this act should result in significant judicial economy. And one of the things that I would add is that not just is it cheaper for families and less expensive, but the hardship on families to go through the court process, I think this bill would be really crucial in helping when you've got it. And it happens, it comes up all the time, that you have a family where mom lives in Portland and then the family's moving to Seattle and they want to move her, and it's a nightmare for the family. It's already been a nightmare to go through the court process system for them, for a lot of people, and then to go through it again emotionally, it's very difficult. They run up more attorney fees, etc., and there have to be more evaluations of mom and all of that. So I just want to point out there's an emotional component that's saved here too. It's stress on the family and stress on the protected person. There are a number of things that are just unresolved in Oregon law, and I don't want to repeat my colleague's testimony here, but for example, we had a case where there was in Alaska, dad lives in Alaska, dad's wife, stepmom of our clients, ended up moving dad to Portland. And so the sisters, the daughters ran and got a guardianship and conservatorship in Alaska. In the meantime, the stepmom is getting one for him here in Oregon. And it was that was the first time I'd run across this, and I was really surprised at how little direction there is in the statute. I mean, there's virtually nothing. It basically says that the judge in Oregon can contact the judge in the other jurisdiction, and they talk. That's basically it. But what I really liked about the provisions in this, in Senate Bill 238, was that it gives criteria. It gives a list of things for the court and for the lawyers to know what the standards should be. So for that reason, I think it's a very well-written bill. I really appreciate the definition of a home state as well as the significant connection state. Again, I could list numerous examples of where that's it comes up. I had another case where I was moved to Kentucky, from Portland to Kentucky, and it would had been such a difficult thing for the family to get this guardianship and conservatorship established for the protected person that when they moved to Kentucky, they just dropped it. And that's someone I think who really could have benefited from monitoring at the court, but they had just had it with the court system. It had been too much. And I think they thought, erroneously, when they moved, that they could just sort of transfer the guardianship, and their attorney was mistaken. There was no procedure for that. So thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'd be pleased to answer any questions from the committee.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
That took so long.
Thank you. Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 238.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wissman.
I move Senate Bill 238 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wissman.
Try that again.
With it?
Yeah. With it.
Yeah. Move Senate Bill 238 to the floor of the due pass. Any further discussion?
I have a, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I'm assuming that the vote in the Senate, Mr. Taylor, was strong, as we don't have any past some issues. Okay. And the work group was done before the amendment, so the amendments reflected consensus by all the.
And the, you mean the original bill?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Representative Barton, would you carry the bill? Thank you. We have the dash twos.
Kind of want to
reopen the work session on Senate Bill 106.
I feel a need to make up for the state plan.
Mr. Chair.
You do.
Representative Wisnett.
I move the dash twos in the Senate Bill 106.
Representative Wisnett moves the dash two amendments in the Senate Bill 106. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I move Senate Bill 106 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 106 as amended to the floor of a due pass.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Okay, Representative Wisnett will carry the bill. Okay, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 559.
Senate Bill 559 aligns the requirements for proof required in a motion to intervene in a juvenile proceeding to the requirements of the motion to intervene. It's no revenue or fiscal impact.
Wendy Johnson, please.
Ask our lawyers if they're okay with the committee. Our legal advice.
Mr. Barker, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. This is the Law Commission's simplest bill of the session. It really is only a three-word bill. It comes to you with our recommendation, and it comes out of our juvenile code work group. Those of you who have been in the legislature for a while know that the juvenile code area is an area that the the commission has been amending for over 10 years. We have an ongoing work group that was originally formed by Senator Kate Brown, and it has been working on chapters 419A, 419B, and 419C, the dependency and delinquency area. When those codes were separated, it wasn't an easy split, and we've had to continue to work on providing more procedures. And so back in 2003, Senate Bill 72 was recommended by the Commission to address the issue of interveners and limited participants in juvenile cases. There were conflicts with Chapter 109, which is the circuit court chapter. So that cleanup was done in 2003, but the existing law in Chapter 419 missed three words. It doesn't exactly parallel. So I will point you to the first page of the bill, which starting on line 27 is a motion for intervention, what you have to state in your motion to intervene. Those criteria A, B, C, and D do not match what the court is supposed to make its ruling upon, which is on page 2, the A, B, C, and D starting on lines 12. It has best interests of the child twice and misses the present a case. And so we're just matching the motion with what the court has defined. Apparently, nobody caught this until a judge recently did and realized that for those criteria were different, and the party did not have to show that the other parties could adequately present the case. And so it really is a cleanup bill, and we'd ask for your support. Be happy to answer any questions.
Wendy, how long did you say you worked on this?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, this probably took just a few minutes to actually fix. The work group has been meeting for over 10 years on fixing lots of pieces of the juvenile code. The limited participant intervention was done in 2003.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger told me he's not going to support any more of these commission bills unless Simeon comes in person. Tells us what all went on. How much went on?
Any questions? Thank you.
That's the
yes.
Are you in a workshop session?
Yeah. Close the public hearing, open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 559 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 559 to the floor with a due pass. Any questions? Call roll, please.
Representative Harris.
Aye. Representative Harris. Aye. Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carries. Then technical fix on the consent calendar, if anybody objects.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
It'll take longer to explain the technical fix than the...